Hello, and welcome to Wiki Politiki, a show designed to bring right and left front and center, to turn the funk into function, and leave the junk at the junction. At a time when so much political discourse is heat without light, Wiki Politiki shines the light of love and truth on the darkened corridors of power, and then brings leading solutionaries into conversation to light the way forward together. Your host is Steve Behrman, author, comedian, and political and spiritual uncommentator. You might know Steve as his cosmic comic alter ego, Swami Beyond Ananda, or as the author of a more serious book with cellular biologist Bruce Lipton, Spontaneous Evolution. If you recognize that crisis precipitates evolution, and judging by the current crises, the chances of precipitation are 100%, this show is for you. Welcome to the Evolutionary Upwising. Now, here is your host, Steve Behrman.
Well, hi there, and welcome to Wiki Politiki Conversations for Co-Creation, where we shed light on the undarkened corridors of power, and we shine light ahead of us to where evolution is leading. The purpose of Wiki Politiki is to bring left and right, front and center, to face the music and dance together, to address real issues rather than defend ideological positions. Well, in 2004, the renowned theologian David Ray Griffin published a book called The New Pearl Harbor, Disturbing Questions About the Bush Administration and 9/11. Well, he was referring to a document released in 1997 by the neoconservative think tank Project for a New American Century called Statement of Principles Rebuilding America's Defenses. The document declared that to mobilize public opinion to support America's 21st century military agenda, a quote-unquote new Pearl Harbor would be needed. David Ray Griffin and numerous other, I call them coincidence-theorists, notice how conveniently the 9/11 attacks were used to justify the war on terror, the Afghanistan invasion, and Iraq war that have become the forever war with no end in sight. It also produced the so-called Patriot Act, which has led to the routine, thorough surveillance of American citizens that we have been asked to accept as the new normal. Well, folks, there's a new normal now, thanks to the current COVID crisis that seeks to install more surveillance and more encroachment of natural rights and human liberties. Our guest this week is MD and vaccine expert Dr. Meryl Nass. She, along with Robert F. Kennedy Jr. of Children's Health Defense, have produced a well-researched document that offers damning evidence that effective early treatments for COVID-19 were intentionally withheld so that vaccines could be fast-tracked without trials as emergency measures. Given how much we've heard about Donald Trump's failure to handle the crisis and how many lives were lost as a result, it may be that many, many more lives were lost because these treatments were withheld. Is this a conspiracy theory or a conspiracy reality? That's what we're hoping to find out in this interview. Meryl Nass has been on the front lines in this battle for quite a while. She's an internist with special interest in vaccine-induced illness, chronic fatigue syndrome, Gulf War illness, fibromyalgia, myalgia, and toxicology. As a biological warfare epidemiologist, she investigated the world's largest anthrax episode in Zimbabwe and developed a model for analyzing epidemics to assess whether they're natural or man-made. She's also an expert on the Gulf War syndrome and its relationship to the anthrax vaccine given the troops, and she's played a major role in creating a coalition that has fought the anthrax vaccine immunization program and is active assisting legal teams defending anthrax vaccine refusers and ill service members in the U.S. and Canada. Well, welcome, Dr. Nass.
Hi, glad to be here.
I'm glad you're with us. Let's jump in. Let's talk about the citizen petition that you and the Children's Health Defense filed with the FDA, asking the agency to immediately revoke the emergency use authorization for COVID vaccines. Sounds very like quite an amazing request. So first, what is the emergency use authorizations and why should they be revoked?
The emergency use authorization is an ability that the government obtained in 2005 as a result of the PREP Act. So after 9/11, a lot of things happened, and among them were these new abilities for the government to deal with emergencies. And so the emergency use authorization was the first sort of legal way that drugs that had not been approved or licensed could be distributed to Americans. And so obviously it has some requirements, and even though it's not required that the drugs or vaccines have gone through clinical trials, it is required that the benefits have to be greater than the risks. So there has to be a cost-benefit analysis. And it's also required that there be no licensed, approved alternative medication. And furthermore, it's required that people must receive informed consent to take one of these unapproved, unlicensed drugs or vaccines. And what informed consent means specifically in the EUA law is that they must be told of alternatives as well as being offered the right to refuse without any coercion or any enticement. Mm-hmm. So that means you can't bribe people and you can't punish people if they choose not to take the vaccine. And obviously what we're seeing is people are being bribed and people are being threatened with punishments if they don't take it. So that is against the EUA law. It turned out that there were licensed drugs that worked both to treat and to prevent COVID. So if you could take a drug once a week that would prevent COVID, it would have the same effect as a vaccine. In fact, it might have higher efficacy. It might have better safety. Turns out there are a number of drugs that are effective to different degrees against COVID that were already licensed. Ivermectin is one. The chloroquine drugs, there are several, at least three mefloquine, chloroquine, and hydroxychloroquine that have efficacy against COVID. Fluvoxamine, which is an antidepressant, and there are some others. Go ahead.
These drugs were in place that were ready to go, and
they were in place. They were licensed. That's important. There had been clinical trials. They existed. If you admitted that they would work against COVID, you could not issue an EUA for vaccines and possibly for drugs to work against COVID. The government, the FDA, and other federal agencies had to pretend that these drugs did not work against COVID. Now, the evidence was strong that they did, because the federal government had actually published two papers, one in 2005 and one in 2014, that showed that the chloroquine drugs were effective against SARS-1. So it's very likely they would be effective against SARS-2. So this is government scientists. One was from Tony Fauci's institute. The other was published by CDC scientists. So it's difficult for those agencies to say they knew nothing about these drugs when they published the research showing that they were effective against SARS.
How did these drugs, so were these drugs withdrawn? Were people simply not told about them? What happened?
There were a lot of different things that happened. Dozens of different things happened. So the FDA, Trump had said that these were good drugs, and he sent one of his emissaries to somehow get drug companies to donate supplies, because I think at least under the old EUA guidelines, you couldn't charge for these drugs. They're experimental. Right? They're not licensed. And in this case, some of them were expired. They can enter the National Strategic Stockpile for distribution by the government, but you can't charge. So under the Trump administration, about 60 million pills were donated of chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine. And the FDA issued a special guidance on how to use them and basically said these drugs could only be used in hospitals. And then later they said only in clinical trials. What the FDA did was to confuse people. The point was that the chloroquine drugs were already licensed and being used for other conditions. I prescribed them for Lyme disease, for lupus, for rheumatoid arthritis, and for malaria. So the drugs that went into the strategic stockpile were donated drugs. They had nothing to do with the commercial drugs that I write a prescription for. Those were not affected in any way. My prescribing of those remained intact. But the FDA tried to make doctors think that there were restrictions on the way they were allowed to prescribe these drugs. And FDA actually can't tell doctors how to use the drugs. FDA's only role is to decide whether these drugs are good or not. What are the indications? What's the safety? Whether to license them? What should be on the label? What the restrictions should be? Once they've done that, unless they have new information, you know, to say we've just learned about a safety problem, they can't tell doctors how to use the drugs. The drugs can be used on label, which means according to the indications that are on the label. So, for example, with chloroquine, malaria is on the label, but Lyme disease is probably not. Yet, it's okay for me to use it for Lyme disease. I get to use my judgment. I explain it to the patients. You know, I give it to them, and it works. So using it for COVID, it would have been off-label, but perfectly acceptable. FDA did its best to confuse doctors that it was not going to be acceptable, that they might get into trouble, and worked with some agencies at the state level to get governors or other authorities at the state level to issue warnings to doctors and to pharmacies, either not to prescribe or not to dispense the drugs for COVID.
So I'm assuming that you were using the hydroxychloroquine drug when people were diagnosed prior to being not just in hospital settings, right?
Correct. I have used it for outpatients all along.
Exactly. So I keep thinking that there is a gap. And this, of course, the doctor, you can talk more about that, McCulloch, I believe his name is, who testified in front of the Senate last summer, who said that there were all of these studies that showed that ivermectin was highly effective and that they were somehow stonewalling the use of ivermectin, and that in fact, even his testimony was debunked by the mainstream media. Am I accurate?
Yeah. So Peter McCullough is a really highly respected guy. He edits two journals. He's a professor, a dean at a Texas medical school. And he said in testimony to the Senate in December, I believe, and in testimony recently to the Texas Senate, that these drugs work. FDA knew that people were using ivermectin as early as April of last year for COVID because of information had been published in Australia about the benefit of ivermectin for COVID on April 3rd of 2020. And yet, a year later, FDA says, well, we haven't looked into ivermectin. You know, that's impossible. FDA can't have sat on a drug, it's actually the most effective drug there is for COVID, and they can't have sat on it and not looked at any of the research when over 50 papers have been published about the benefits of ivermectin for COVID, either as prevention, you can take it weekly or biweekly, because it has a very long half-life. The half-life in the body is about 50 days, and the chloroquine drugs also have a very long half-life, so you take it, and months later, you still have some of this drug in your system, and they both concentrate in the lungs more than in the blood. So small doses can be very effective against COVID. Anyway, so FDA did not take the same actions against ivermectin that it did against the chloroquine drugs. It later issued guidance to doctors that they should only use it in a clinical trial. So most of my peers are frightened to use it for COVID, I'm not, you know, let the FDA take me to court, you know, I'll show that they're wrong and I'm correct. But most doctors, you know, they've been beaten down over the last 10 or 20 years, and they're really frightened to do anything on their own anymore. So FDA has warned doctors about ivermectin, but not in as big a way as it did with the chloroquine drugs, possibly because it got the effect it wanted. Many countries have banned the use of these drugs for COVID, and a few countries have lifted the ban. The ban was lifted in South Africa as a result of a legal case, and in Zimbabwe after several government ministers died of COVID, and now it's widely used in Zimbabwe. It's used a lot in a number of Latin American countries and in parts of India. But again, many people believe the mainstream, which has said that it's dangerous and it shouldn't be used for COVID, that it's not effective. So it's really a question of who do you believe?
Well, yes. And I mean, I keep thinking, you know, back in all of this conversation about Donald Trump kind of fumbling the handling of this issue. And so how many people died? And I have to think about how many people died because they did not have access to treatment until perhaps it was too late. And to me, that is just, I mean, so strikingly evil. It's hard to wrap myself around that.
That is the evil. That is where doctors have really fallen down. I mean, you do not wait to treat a patient until they're on death's door. You don't never do that, not for any disease. You don't tell people to go home, do nothing, take Tylenol, and then show up at the hospital if you get really sick. I mean, that is insane. We treat everything as soon as it shows up on our doorstep. Except COVID. It makes no sense.
Exactly.
We have drugs that are extremely effective. The chloroquines and ivermectin and some of these other drugs are extremely effective if you start them early, before there's a large viral load. By the time you've waited a week or two, the virus isn't even growing anymore. And so a drug that works against viral growth is no longer going to work. The chloroquines have to be given at the beginning. Ivermectin, though, has multiple mechanisms of action, and it still has some efficacy late in the disease. So ivermectin can be useful at any time in the course. The chloroquines really need to be given in the first week, or else don't bother. The fact that the government has really worked hard, spent a lot of money to stop people from obtaining these drugs and stop doctors from prescribing them is a crime. Ivermectin is used over-the-counter in most countries. And chloroquine drugs are over the counter in Africa. I mean, I've bought them over the counter. There have been billions of doses of these drugs used in the world. They're considered very safe. They're considered safe in pregnancy, which is remarkable. Very few drugs are considered safe in pregnancy. And yet, the chloroquine drugs are recommended when other drugs can't be used in pregnancy. No evidence of birth defects. What happened in the United States and in Europe was that, and in Brazil, four large clinical trials were set up with excessive doses. So this is a drug, chloroquine drug, not ivermectin. If you give them at a dose about three or four times the normal dose, you can kill somebody. And so clinical trials were designed in which, for some reason, that is difficult to know why. Three of these trials used the identical dose, the identical dosing schedule. There had to have been some mutual discussion about this ahead of time. And the Brazil trial used a bit of a higher dose. And the Brazil trial killed a lot of people. So after they killed 16 out of, I think, 41 people in the beginning, in the first week of the trial, and the average age was only about 50. So these were young people, not elderly. And so they stopped. They had a normal dose arm.
I'm going to have to interrupt you for just a second. We're going to have to take a break. We're a few minutes late on that. So let's come back and complete this conversation about these phony trials. This is Steve Bannon on Wiki Politiki with our guest, Meryl Nass. We'll be back in a very short minute or two.
Connecting you with the best of the conscious minds in the world. Om Times Radio. IOM FM. Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Om Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
My name is Victor Furman. Some call me The Voice. I've always been fascinated with human nature, spirituality, science, and the crossroads at which they meet. Join me Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern on Om Times Radio, and we'll explore these topics and so much more on Destination Unlimited.
COVID-19, brought to you by CDC and the Ad Council.
If you're feeling increasingly lonely right now, you're not alone. It's totally normal. Even though we may not be able to get together in person, connecting virtually with friends and family still gives you a chance to interact with people and may help raise your spirits. Join a virtual book club, set up group text chats, or online video coffee breaks with coworkers.
Find more self-care and coping tips at coping-19.org.
Well, we're back with our guest, Dr. Meryl Nass. We're talking about the very strange and troubling behavior of our Food and Drug Administration, Center for Disease Control, et cetera, as well as the other countries that have either thwarted the use of these proven medicines to treat COVID in its early stages, or created clinical trials that were designed to literally use overkill and kill people so that those medicines would be discredited. We'll come back to that, but I want to actually take another tack here, and that has to do with the adverse effects reported around the new vaccines that are being given for COVID. How do these compare with the adverse effects of past vaccines, and how do we know about these reported adverse effects?
At the beginning of the vaccine program, last December, the CDC said that they were going to be using 11 different data sources to evaluate the safety of the COVID vaccines, and that this was going to be the most, you know, strenuous, careful evaluation of any vaccine. Well, that turned out not to be true. So there was one database which has always been open to the public, and that's called VAERS, Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, and anyone is able to report to that. So you or I can just input information into that database. A relative of somebody who's been injured, a parent, a doctor, you know, any party can enter information. And therefore, the CDC and FDA don't consider that database to be statistically valid. They they say, you know, anyone could enter a false report. So the purpose of that database is only to give a signal, a red flag, and then indicate that CDC or FDA will have to study that question using one of their better databases, and they have a lot of them. The number one database that CDC uses is called VSD, Vaccine Safety Data Link, and it basically is connected to the medical records of 12 million Americans that use HMOs. And so in that database, for a normal vaccine, they've got the date you got the vaccine, and then all the inpatient and outpatient visits you made subsequently. So it's very good for evaluating other vaccines. But in the case of this vaccine, and one wonders if this was not set up deliberately that way, the vast majority of people who got this vaccine got it at mass clinics. It was done outside of your own doctor and your own office, and it was free. There were no insurance claims. So the normal databases that use your doctor's medical records or your insurance claims don't work for this vaccine. And CDC mm-hmm. behaved as if they had no idea that was going to happen. And said, yeah. You know, we're having a really hard time tracking deaths because, you know, they're not in our insurance database and they're not in the VSD, and which is bullshit, because CDC gets all the death certificates. CDC gets all the vaccine data. So when you're, so far, up until now, when we're starting to give the vaccines at doctor's offices, you had to make an appointment to get your vaccine. You had to input all of this data about yourself. That first went to the state, and then it went to CDC. So CDC has data, and they know who's gotten the vaccine. They have these other databases, like the death certificates. They know who's died, you know, and whether vaccine injury was one of the diagnoses or not. They could put all that information together, but they have certainly chosen not to give the public any of it.
Mm-hmm. There's all sorts of conflicting reports about, you know, how many people have died from this vaccine and compared to other vaccines and so on. But continue.
Yeah. So the thing is, CDC changed VAERS this year.
Yeah.
And I now, looking back, I'm thinking they changed it in order for it not to be comparable to prior years. But yes, about 100 times more deaths, for example, or injuries are being reported to VAERS for these COVID vaccines than have been reported for any other vaccines. I mean, the numbers are unbelievably high. So that's remarkable, and it should not go without incredible attention from the federal health agencies, but so far they are being very blasé about it.
Wow. Okay.
It's easier to look at anaphylaxis. So
yeah.
What CDC did was take cases of anaphylaxis that were reported to VAERS, pretending that VAERS was as good as their other databases, which it isn't, and they know that. This was, you know, misconduct, and said, well, if we look at all the anaphylaxis cases reported to VAERS, really the numbers are not too far off other vaccines. So we only get between 2 and 3 cases per million, assuming all the anaphylaxis cases that occurred were reported to VAERS. So they said, well, it doesn't worry us. Well, then Mass General and the Brigham Hospital in Boston said, well, 50 or 60,000 of our employees got the Moderna or the Pfizer vaccine, and we checked with them to find out how many had anaphylaxis. And using their own employees, they found the rate was actually 50 to 100 times higher than what was reported in VAERS, and that what CDC had claimed was the rate. So now that's anaphylaxis is a good one because it happens right after you get a vaccine, you know, and it's mm-hmm. an allergic reaction. So it's very easy to link that to a vaccine, whereas many other side effects are harder to link. But if you get anaphylaxis within 30 minutes of getting vaccinated, it's pretty clear what did it.
Mm-hmm.
So you would have thought CDC would have come out with a statement saying, gee, maybe the anaphylaxis cases are greater than we thought, but they didn't. The American College of Allergy had advised people, don't get this vaccine unless you're getting it in a place where you can be resuscitated in case you have a cardiac arrest or a severe anaphylactic reaction. But again, you know, those warnings are not really getting out to the public very well.
So it really sounds like, and again, I like to use the word coincidence theorists instead of conspiracy theorists, because coincidence is a wow, what an amazing coincidence that these other drugs were dismissed and deplatformed in order to make room for these vaccinations. And what an amazing coincidence that they changed the system of reporting and that there seems to be a contradiction between what the hospitals in Massachusetts are reporting and what the American College of Allergists warns, and what we're being told through the mainstream system. So, I mean, clearly, one would have to have a real lack of imagination to imagine that there's not some relationship between the way the CDC and perhaps the World Health Organization is treating these vaccinations. And of course, I've been noticing over the past several years, there's been really a lot of mainstream publicity to get vaccinated for other things, and a lot of seeking to deplatform the quote-unquote anti-vax movement. Before we talk more about these vaccines and some of the problems, what is your, you know, as an observer of this situation for 25 or 30 years, what's your assessment of the overall picture? Why is that happening? Why are we being given misleading information? And why is this being withheld from the public?
You touched on an interesting question that I've been reformulating my thoughts on, which is, why did the pharmaceutical industry put so much money and effort into trying to change the law in many states to get rid of exemptions for vaccinations? So that's been going on for about 6 or 7 years in the U.S., from state to state. And many states, including mine, lost the ability for children to get a religious or a philosophic exemption from vaccines. And so there, in California, you went from having 2,000 kindergartners homeschooled to 7,000 as a result of the loss of vaccine exemptions. And that was reported by the LA Times a couple of years ago. So I thought it was because the industry was bringing in new vaccines, and because the 21st Century CARES Act, which was passed right at the end of the Obama administration in December of 2016, enhanced the liability waiver, improved the liability waiver for manufacturers, so that and said that every vaccine, as soon as it was licensed, had to go to a committee at CDC to see if it could be added to the child schedule. Once it's added to the child schedule, there's no manufacturer liability for injuries. Also, that bill said that every vaccine that's recommended for pregnant women would now come under this liability umbrella. There'd be a waiver of liability. So there's been a sort of a gold rush in trying to develop vaccines for in pregnancy. And so I just thought, well, they're getting a better deal, and that's why these companies want to get rid of exemptions, you know, have a slightly bigger market. I mean, they already had a market that was about 96-97% of kids, and they wanted to move that up to 99%. You know, it didn't seem like it was that many kids. It wasn't really going to make a difference in terms of herd immunity. Why were they doing it? But now that we have the COVID vaccines, which are completely novel, we don't know really. We can't assess what they're injecting into us. We can't, unless you sequence the vaccine. And so far, the U.S. government has not allowed those bottles to get out of its control. So we don't really know what's in the bottle. We don't know what the code is for the messenger RNA. And we don't know whether something else might be put in the vaccines. You know, you just have to wonder what's going on. Why do they want so much to vaccinate us? Even people who've recovered from COVID, who will have robust, healthy people who have recovered, will likely have much better immunity than they would get from a vaccine. And yet the government wants all those people to be vaccinated and has not approved a single test to show that you are immune after recovery. So it's impossible right now. If you want to fly on an airplane and you want to prove you already had COVID and take a test, there is no test you can take and use to get on that airplane, or to get into, you know, if you're in New York State, to get into a theater or some other entity that requires vaccination. You've got to have a vaccination.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I can't tell you why the push to vaccinate, but it's odd that all of the first four vaccines that were given, billions and billions of taxpayer money in Project Warp Speed, all four used novel DNA or RNA technology. You would think if the issue was to get people a vaccine as quickly as possible, they would have thrown in at least one using an old technology that would be more likely, you know, to get to the finish line than these completely novel technologies, but they didn't. So you just wonder, why did it happen like that? Don't know.
Okay, well, that's a good answer. But certainly, it would certainly seem that the public interest is not being considered. I would probably say it that way. It doesn't seem that way. In terms of all of these vaccinations that children get, that's a whole other issue. You know, it's been a long time since I was a kid, but I remember a few vaccinations, the smallpox vaccination, the whooping cough, all of these things, very few. And now how many have any idea how many vaccinations, for example, kids in California who want to go to school have to get?
Yeah, it varies by the state. So CDC makes a list of the recommended vaccines, which is about 70 from age 0 to 18. excuse me. That would be considering that the MMR was three vaccines, measles, mumps, rubella. So it would be 70 shots, 70 different vaccinations.
Mm-hmm.
And probably, you know, there will be many more. Partly as a result of this 21st Century Cures Act, which incentivizes manufacturers to produce vaccines that will be added to the children's schedule.
We got a break coming up. We're going to take a break for about a minute and a half. We'll be back again with our guest, Dr. Meryl Nassen, talking about the petition that was just put in front of the Food and Drug Administration. We'll be back shortly.
Free your mind with Om Times Radio, IOM FM.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
The United States has the highest rate of incarceration in the world. At the Equal Justice Initiative, we believe mass incarceration has to end. There is this presumption of dangerousness and guilt that gets assigned to Black and brown people. We have to confront our history of racial injustice and commit to a new era of truth. There's something better waiting for us, something that feels more like freedom. Truth can inspire change. Please learn more at EJI.org.
Well, we have a lot to cover in this last segment, so I'll tell you, Dr. Nass, what I want to talk about, and let's see if we can parse out these three separate things. First, I want to talk about what are euphemistically called breakthrough cases, COVID cases, and even deaths that have emerged in vaccinated people. Then I also want to talk about, the media stonewall. Well, actually, what you are looking to accomplish with this petition in front of, the Food and Drug Administration, and finally,
why is it that people seem so reluctant to look at what seems to be obviously damning facts? So let's begin with the breakthrough cases. What do you know about those?
All right, there are over 10,000 breakthrough cases that the CDC has you know, vaccinated and got the condition. You know, that happens with every vaccine. No vaccine is 100% effective. The best one is measles, and it's in the 90s. And most vaccines are, you know, maybe 70-80% effective. So if you, you know, vaccinate 10 people and expose them all to the disease, probably two or three are going to come down with the disease. Mm-hmm. So I was not surprised by breakthrough cases, but they've been used, you know, CDC says on its website, well, you know, we can't guarantee if you've been vaccinated, you're not going to get the disease. We can't guarantee. You might have an asymptomatic case.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't know. So that sort of left them off the hook. And we don't know how common breakthrough cases are. We do not know what the efficacy of these vaccines is. The clinical trials, I don't even want to go into it, but they were done in a very shoddy fashion to try to get cases as quickly as possible under very minimal criteria. Basically, if you had a cough, you know, and diarrhea, that was and a positive PCR, you were a case. But the PCRs had a cycle threshold that was so high that they had very high false positives, at least at that time. We think they've subsequently been turned down. And I was involved mm-hmm. with another citizen petition to FDA about 6 months ago regarding those cycle thresholds and the way they would give you probable cases. So anyway, you know, breakthrough cases, they're always going to be breakthrough cases. What we need to know is how often they occur, and that's what we don't know.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's talk about the intent of this petition. Why did you file it, and what's the intent of the petition? What would you like to see happen?
Okay. The intent of the petition is to tell FDA, we know what you did wrong. We know that you did not follow the law. And we're giving you the opportunity now to take back the emergency use authorizations you've issued for these vaccines, and particularly for children, you know, and then we'll go away. But if you don't do that, which we don't expect them to do, you know, we will be back and we can litigate against these issues if you do not give us a satisfactory answer. So by showing them that we know what the law says, we know, you know, the niceties of the details of the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act are very complicated. Not too many lawyers know about that. I and the team I worked with, two of whom were friends of mine who had worked on the anthrax vaccine case 15 to 20 years ago and got the license revoked on anthrax vaccine, and also got a judge to stop a mandate of the vaccine when it was under EUA. So that's the only case historically that's ever occurred in the United States in which there was a mandate applied to an EUA product, and the Judge Emmett Sullivan revoked that. So we sort of approached this in the same way with attorneys from Children's Health Defense and said, they're doing some of the same things here with the COVID vaccines that they did with the anthrax vaccine, and we were able to go from there and pull this together.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So basically, you want to let them know that you know, you're holding them accountable, even though they're really not holding themselves accountable. You also mentioned COVID vaccinations for children, and you know, there are some people who think it's counterindicated for children, or at the very least unnecessary. What's your take on that?
Children are a special case because they can't give informed consent. So here you're subjecting them to basically a clinical trial. Well, no matter what anybody says, these are experimental products. Under the law, they are investigational experimental products. And you can't force a child to have them. I mean, these things have not been litigated yet, but if they get litigated, you know, the children will win. So children don't have to have these products. The products are clearly dangerous. We know there have been...
Oops, we lost you for a second. Are you there? Here we are. You're back for a little bit.
So it only lost you. Children have a very low incidence.
Oops.
There's.
You're out of reception, I think.
Risk benefit for an elderly person, and given all the, and you have to do that risk benefit calculation for an EUA. So, you know, we think definitely children are going to be harmed, and it's not through any fault of their own. You know, adults can choose whether to get the vaccine. Children are not choosing for themselves. So that's the problem there.
So now let's look at the issue that, I mean, what we're seeing is there is a media stonewall that you're speaking into. I mean, if you look at what happened with Dr. McCullough's report, it was immediately discredited by mainstream media. And it's kind of weird for awakening progressives to recognize that if they want to hear any modicum of truth about this, they have to tune into Tucker Carlson on Fox News. So as somebody who's been with this for a long time and probably coming from a more progressive perspective, what's going on here in terms of people's willingness or unwillingness to look at what would seem to be an obvious perpetration?
I'm going outside my expertise here to give
That's
you some
explanation.
I think there are two important pieces of this. And the first is that there is an incredible level of confusion about what's going on. So every fact you try to get hold of regarding COVID is slippery. You know, what are the real numbers? What, you know, what is the disease? Is there even a virus? You know, did it come from a lab? I mean, you can argue about all of it. And so the vast majority of people are, you know, in a cloud, in a confused cloud, where what can they really believe? Who can they believe? Are they, and they're frightened. Of course they're frightened. Everybody is frightened. You know, if I get this, will I be okay? How will I get treated? You know, will I go, or what if I have a heart attack and I have to go to the hospital? I could catch it there. So there's an enormous amount of fog and fear. And given that, I think people are left to their trusted advisors, their trusted sources, and basically tribalism. You know, mm-hmm. we're not very strong individually, but if we have a tribe, you know, that tribe will protect us. And I think, you know, our enemies, who are probably the elites who were responsible for withholding drugs and possibly for doing these experiments, I think it's, you know, it can't be a coincidence that the NIH published this article in 2014, that Tony Fauci's part of the NIH published an article about using repurposed drugs for MERS and SARS, you know, and then he has worked so hard to suppress the use of these drugs. So with the tribalism, I think people have fallen back on political parties. And mm-hmm. people like, I mean, if you throw away, as I have come to do, the FDA, the CDC, the NIH, what are you left with? You know, there are no authorities out there. And it's even a bigger fog. You know, people are not willing to just jettison the whole government and say the government is in a conspiracy against us. And nor was I. You know, you interviewed me a year ago, and I had just done this work on the suppression of hydroxychloroquine. Mm-hmm. You know, and it had turned up 50 different ways that hydroxychloroquine has been suppressed. You know, it became very clear to me it was a conspiracy. There was no other possible explanation for what had happened in so many different countries, you know, identical, non-intuitive, unscientific, you know, regulations and laws and recommendations had come down that led to a lot of people dying. A lot of, as you said, a lot of people dying. Probably more than 1 million people have died in the world because of these terrible recommendations. And, you know, it's really hard to believe that people could have done that. I don't know, you know, how this came to be, but, you know, with a lot of people in a lot of different positions, it happened. Mm-hmm. It happened. And so there is a conspiracy, and the question is, you know, we have to peel back and understand who initiated it. And there are, you know, there are hints about some of the large foundations that were intimately involved with some of these decisions and with setting up these poisonous clinical trials. But anyway, I think, you know, people are confused and scared. And basically we revert back. We're not using the logical parts of our mind. We're reverting back to reliance on our tribe.
Yep, and I think that's what fear does. And, you know, there's fear on both sides. There's on one side, there's fear of COVID. There's fear of catching it. There's fear of being disabled by it, long COVID, et cetera, or infecting vulnerable people. On the other side, there's fear of losing our ability to have any kind of sovereignty over our own body, and that in order to function in this, I call it a grave new world, in order to function in the grave new world, we will have to take these experimental treatments or not be able to travel to see our friends and family or go to a movie or et cetera, et cetera. So, it certainly seems like there is a some kind of a top-down desire to exert control over human beings, and there's probably as many theories about why that's happening, et cetera, as there are writers about it. In terms of where we are now and what we can do, is there anything on the horizon that gives you hope that we would actually be able to lift the veils on this, what's your sense of that? And then what about actually getting to the point of herd immunity without the unheard of impunity that we're experiencing now?
Well, you know, many parts of the United States are probably basically at herd immunity. You know, everybody has a different susceptibility to the illness, et cetera. But there's not that much of it out there. We're down to where we were last May or June, at the bottom, after the March April peak and before the summer peak and before the winter peak. You know, we're right down there. I don't think we're going to have another peak. I think this is petering out, I hope. In my state, there are no mask requirements as of yesterday for anyone, indoors or outdoors. Now, the purpose may be to, you know, cause another little peak before this thing goes away, but I think we're done. But anyway, mm-hmm. So there are places you can get the right medicines that you need. There are three organizations that have lists of doctors who will treat you, and there are pharmacies that will overnight the meds to you. So first group is the American Association of Physicians and Surgeons. You can go to their website and find it. The second is the FLCCC, which is a group of intensive care physicians. Their website will show you where to go to get the meds. And the third is the AFLDS, the America's Frontline Doctors. They also have a doctor list that will treat you if you get sick or if you want to get prophylaxis or if you want to get the medications and hold on to them ahead of time. That's a good idea. And I think once you buy yourself, the ivermectin is what I would recommend. You may or may not benefit from some hydroxychloroquine also, but there are doctors in California who treat with both just to be on the safe side. That'd be Dr. George Fareed and Dr. Brian Tyson. I think once you have the medications, you can let go of your fear. You'll be okay. As soon as you get sick, you talk to your doctor. If this sounds like COVID, start the medications and you'll get over it quickly. And then you can start to think again. I think what's starting to happen is people on the left and right are realizing that there's a different common enemy, and that the kabuki dance in Congress and in the state legislatures is only a kabuki dance. And we need to for it. These people are actors. We need to get better legislators in at the state level. People need to think about running. Scott Jensen, physician, is running for governor. He happens to be a Republican, but he's been telling the truth about this COVID pandemic. He looked at the death certificates in Minnesota and found that they had blown up the death due to COVID by about 30% extra.
Wow.
So I think there's positive things happening.
Good. I really want to thank you, Dr. Meryl Ness, for being our guest and being honest and not going overboard with speculation, but simply laying out the facts. And yes, I think with a lower level of fear, more people are going to be willing to look at the real deal, and we may have a great uprising. Thank you, Dr. Ness, for being our guest on Wiki Politiki. This is Steve Behrman. Thank you again.
Take care.